You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of July 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
More than 54 years ago, at the height of the Cold War, the United States closed its embassy in Havana. Today, I can announce that the United States has agreed to formally reestablish diplomatic relations with the Republic of Cuba.
President Barack Obama announces the reopening of the U.S. embassy in Cuba in a historic gesture symbolizing the thawing of relations between the two Cold War enemies. I'll be asking my guests Raffaello Pantucci and Samira Shackle whether a couple of new buildings really means that U.S.-Cuban relations have changed. Then we'll hear the latest on the Greek debt default. The nation is accepting new bailout conditions from the IMF, but there's still the small matter of the 1.6 billion euro hole in their finances that nobody in Greece seems to have. Staying in finance, we'll also look to China and its new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank as it continues to attract founding members. Will it become a force to be reckoned with? And what will that mean for China's international influence? All that plus a bit more here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and the freelance journalist Samira Shackle. Raffaello and Samira, welcome to you both. We begin today with the United States. Barack Obama has just announced plans to reopen the U.S. embassy in Cuba. In the speech delivered in the White House, Obama said the United States had been clinging to a policy that was not working, but also acknowledged the two countries still have very real differences, Cuba's record on freedom of speech being one of those. But it is perhaps a historic day. The US has had no embassy in Cuba since 1961, and it's a further show of the changing in relationships between the two countries. Samira, we're talking about a bit more, really, aren't we, than a bricks and mortar building. There is symbolism here. This is actually a bit of a big change for America.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the symbolic value is hugely important. And, you know, Obama's planning, I think, to visit Cuba before the end of his term, which would make him the first president to do so in about 60 years, which I think the symbolic value of that can't really be overplayed. I mean, both countries have had these sort of interest sections in the other country, which I suppose does some of the work of an embassy. But I think something about formally re-establishing official ties is something that's sort of established as a significant symbol of a sort of willingness to work together all over the world.
And yet, Raffaello Pantucci, it's a bit strange, this, in that it's one of those decisions that now it's happened, no one's going to reverse. No, you know, however much a Republican might say, oh, we don't like it, they're not going to come into office in 2016 or early 2017 and say, well, we're definitely closing down the embassy in Cuba again. We can't possibly deal with a communist nation.
Well, they could block it. They could really hold it up. I mean, the actual appointment of an ambassador is something that has to go through Congress, and they could kick up a huge fuss and make it very difficult for that person to go through. We've already had some congressmen come out saying as much. I think you're right. It seems like an irreversible process, and I think that this is going to be one of those things which, you know, we're going to look back on the Obama presidency, and this is going to be one of those big things that he managed to do. He opened up Iran, and he got us connected back to Cuba. You know, those will be the big legacy things. But I don't think that it's a totally smooth trajectory, because there are some really hardline people in the US Congress who frankly will block this, not only for their own reasons around having issues around a communist country and whatever else, but also more generally who will just use this to partisan point score. I mean, we've seen that time and again across the board in Washington. So, you know, I thought in Obama's comments, he made an interesting point, which I thought was quite specific, and I think pointed to a real potential problem they have. He said, why should Washington stand in the way of the people? And this after he pointed out there's been repeated sort of surveys in Cuba and in the US to say, we all want this to happen. You know, politicians make it happen kind of thing. So, but I think he's pointing to something that's really quite a serious problem there, which is that US politics, domestic politics, could hold this process up.
And yet, on that point, it's, the US has no problem having diplomatic relations with China. In fact, it's bending over backwards to have all sorts of different relations with China. And it's that sort of strange dichotomy, that sort of hypocrisy, that really made this policy of not talking to Cuba stand out, Rafaela.
No, I agree. I mean, I think it seemed an absurd thing, and it seemed an anachronism of a past age. I thought it was also quite interesting in his comments when he made that point about, he said the year of his birth was the year in which, I think, guess who had been President Eisenhower, wasn't it, who announced the embargo in the first place? You know, and he said he pointed out that Eisenhower said eventually it'll get lifted. Now, sort of 60 years later, it is actually happening. I think it feels like it's something left over, an anachronism for a past time. But, you know, these sorts of things can get sucked into sort of these vortexes of a very specific domestic politics in the US. And, you know, it does seem odd that, you know, the United States retains very strong links, has a regular strategic and economic dialogue, which they just had, as you pointed out, with the Chinese, while they won't talk to the Cubans, this little island off the coast. You know, it's a sort of odd set of choices, but, you know, history leaves us with some bizarre things.
Samira, do you think that Barack Obama obviously has one eye not just on thinking, well, this is the right thing to do, but also thinking about his foreign policy legacy? And as Rafaela points out, he may well be able to point back to, well, look, there was Cuba, and, you know, and obviously many people hope there'll be a deal with Iran as well. So he may have that in his favour, some would argue, but that doesn't necessarily mean that foreign policy is going to be looked back as being the highlight of the Obama presidency.
Not necessarily, but I think that, I mean, I think a lot of presidents certainly do in their, particularly in second terms, I think, have this eye on the legacy, and also it's easier to focus on foreign policy decisions which might not be the biggest vote winners or the most popular or whatever it is in the second term, when the stakes are somewhat lower and you're not quite so taken over by the sort of domestic political and economic reforms that might take precedence in the first term. So I think that there's no doubt an element of that, but I think it also does fit in with the mission statement that Obama said when he took office in 2008, you know, that he wanted to sort of reimagine America's relationship with the world. And I think this is probably part of that.
And Rafaela, from Cuba's point of view, because obviously there's been a lot of discussion even just here tonight about what this means for America and so on. Cuba's got to be, the Cuban government has to be slightly wary here, doesn't it? Because the more they open up, the more there are reforms, the more the Cuban people might start pushing for more openness and democracy in Cuba itself.
That's perfectly possible, but I think the current administration there, I mean, I have to confess, I'm not huge knowledge about Cuban politics in great detail, but it certainly seemed, all the signals I've read in the various articles that I've tried to follow around this, it has struck me that, you know, I think that there is a sense in the Cuban government that there is a way of sort of managing your authoritarianism out in a way. And there is a way of opening up in such a fashion that maybe you can sort of gently move in a direction rather than the sort of overnight collapse, for example, that you would have seen in a country like Russia in the post-Soviet period. So I have a sense that the government there probably feels like it's able to manage this process. It's hoping that in building a relationship with the United States, it can start to develop its economy, and maybe it will have to open up in some other ways. But, you know, it's a sort of more managed process than the sort of overnight, you know, switch from one to the other, which is, I think, what they're probably most worried about.
Okay, let's move on to Greece and this never-ending story. Today, the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras accepted many of the concessions required by the country's creditors in order to pay back the billions of euros that it owes the International Monetary Fund. However, all parties are now in uncharted territory, with Greece overnight becoming the first developed nation not to meet its financial obligations to the IMF. There's still a 1.6 billion euro bill that is still on the table. Samira Shackle, we've got this referendum still, almost certain to go ahead at this weekend. We're in a very dangerous moment for Greece, which I feel like we've been saying pretty much every day for the past 5 years.
Sounds familiar.
Where we don't quite know if we're in the end game or even near the end game or where it's going to go. But it certainly feels like the number of options are running out here.
Yeah, I think so. And as you say, it's been something that's been unfolding over the course of many years. And I think that sort of sense internationally this week that it was the crisis point and this was it and Greece was suddenly going to collapse. And actually, you know, that sort of economic collapse that we're talking about is something that does take place over many weeks and months. And whether there's that seismic moment of, yes, it's become the first developed nation to default on an IMF loan, going into the sort of Distinguished Company of Sudan, Somalia, and what was the other one?
Zimbabwe.
But, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, you flick a switch, they don't pay the loan back and suddenly Greece becomes the new Somalia. You know, it's sort of, at the moment, it's something as simple, you know, they
take a few years to get there, right?
Exactly. You know, they can't access cash. I mean, that's been the big thing, hasn't it? The 60 euro cash limit. But it's over the next few weeks and months that will really start to hit people, as salaries can't be paid, as hospitals can't order new medicines and so on. So I think it's, in terms of the immediate crisis, I think it will take a few weeks more and hopefully some solution will be found before then.
Raffaella, we're going to talk a little bit later about another big financial institution that's just been created. But all of this also undermines the authority somewhat of the IMF, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, what do other creditors of the IMF do with the debts that they might owe? And it also draws into question many of the IMF's policies towards Greece over the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, there's many different international institutions that are coming out looking bad from this. I mean, not only have we got the question of the Greek government and their sort of inability to apparently manage some of these problems. And, you know, for example, a friend pointed out to me, you know, why did Tsipras have to go to Russia, which was essentially a 3-day trip, you know, days before this crisis deadline was coming up? It seems, I don't know, and I met some Greek politicians over the past year who don't seem as agitated as you feel like they should be about this impending crisis. So I think there's a question of mismanagement there. I think from a European Union perspective, there's been a huge level of mismanagement in how to sort of handle Greece and how to do it. You know, bureaucrats in Brussels will sort of issue these edicts and these very deterministic statements about things that will or will not be done. And, you know, without necessarily thinking about the sort of human consequences of these things. And I think, you know, you can telescope that up to the IMF as well, who sort of, you know, gives loans out to countries with very restrictive policy in some cases and others more open. You know, I think it's slightly variable, but, you know, doesn't necessarily take into consideration some of the sort of human dynamics that actually play out on the ground.
Samira, there's been, you know, a lot of criticism of Syriza from other European governments in particular. And yet, within the Greek population, there is no indication that even if people are getting fed up with Syriza, they want to rush back to the centre-left and centre-right parties, who, as they see it, let them down so badly over the last, well, not just 5 years, but however many years you want to go back. Do you worry about where Greece turns if, for example, the Syriza government falls?
I think certainly, yeah. I mean, when you've got such a significant number of votes in the last election going to very extreme parties like Golden Dawn on the right wing, I mean, that's just a blatantly neo-Nazi party. So I think there is a worry, and that there's also a sense that, you know, Syriza came in on a protest vote. And I think, you sort of have to see it in the context of Greek politics over the last 60 years, if not more. It's always been very intensely polarised between left and right, sort of since the Second World War, certainly. And I think that sort of polarisation is there already, and then, as in any country, is sort of exacerbated, and the extremes on either side are empowered in a time of crisis, and this has been an extended crisis. And so I think that certainly should be a concern for anyone about which way it goes if this is to fall. It's been a very tempestuous time, and the population's increasingly desperate, and I think it's sort of something to really keep an eye on what happens next if Syriza does fall.
Okay, we'll take a short break. Samira Shackle and Raffaella Pantucci, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. We're back after this.
Monocle loves books. We love them so much that we have our very own books team in partnership with our friends at Gestalten in Berlin. We've already launched the Muscular and Handsome Monocle Guide to Better Living and the Monocle Guide to Good Business, plus the London and New York titles in our new hardback City Guide series. And coming your way this summer are the giant Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes, that's packed with inspiring residences and practical advice, and City Guides for Hong Kong and Tokyo too. Monocle's books offer a world of new experiences between the covers, whether you're staying at home or seeking new adventures. See our full lineup of well-turned-out titles at monocle.com and on the shelves of all great bookstores.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Raffaello Pantucci and Samira Shackle. Now, earlier this week, China hosted the signing ceremony for the Asian Invasion. Let's start that one again. It's a tricky one, as we were discussing before we went on air. The Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or the AIIB, or AIIB. The acronym will be worked out, I'm sure. It's a new financial body with more than 50 members, including Germany, the UK, Australia and South Korea. It's said that the new institution will serve as a competitor to other global bodies, such as the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. But was there really anything wrong with those? And why do we need a new one? Raffaello, what was the thinking behind this originally for China?
I think there's a number of things that are at play here. I mean, the Chinese have sort of been on this big push out since Xi Jinping has come into power. He's been all about developing border relationships and doing lots of these, developing these infrastructure corridors emanating out from China, going through Central Asia, going through South Asia, and going out to the seas. And they've set up all sorts of funding vehicles to try to help implement a lot of these projects. And AIIB is really part of this. It's one of these sorts of things that it's very much a Chinese push. They're the biggest stakeholder in it. They're the biggest shareholder in it. They have veto power over the ultimate sort of decisions that the institution's able to make as to where to do projects. And it really fits into a sort of bigger Chinese foreign policy push that we're seeing. On the other side, I mean, there has been some questioning around some of the current infrastructure banks, in particular in Asia. We talked a bit about the sort of IMF before and some of the issues around that. And people have been angry around the sort of leaderships of the IMF and World Bank and the fact they're pretty much a stitch up between the US and Europe, right? And the ADB, which is the other one which was sort of pushed out, was very much a Japanese-controlled entity. And this one is trying to sort of be the other one, and it's trying to give China a voice, or China's trying to sort of impose its own voice kind of at the table as well.
And that's the thing, Samira Shackle, isn't it? The attraction to many countries that are either not aligned to the West or want to see a sort of a rival power base. Mm-hmm. They have often worried that, the World Bank is always run by an American, the IMF is always run by a European, and they are very much run by those Western, very small, small number of countries, and everyone else just has to accept that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think there's an increasing desire among lots of countries in the world to have somewhere else to turn to. And I mean, we were just talking about Greece, and I think that there's, some international frustration sometimes with the way those organizations are run. I think also, just adding to what Raf was just saying, there's some frustration within China that those institutions that are there in a way sort of haven't really kept pace with the way the world's economies are changing and rebalancing. I mean, you've got over the last 30 years China's economy just growing at such a speed, and India's, and I think India's one of the second partners in this new bank, growing at such a speed, and yet that's not represented at the top of any of these international financial organizations. There's sort of the more established powers haven't made space for China at the top of those institutions. So I think it was probably a matter of time before they set up something like this.
Raffaello, I'm intrigued as to why other countries, Western countries, would join this, because the United States was from the start quite adamant that they wanted nothing to do with this. They saw it as a Chinese vehicle. If they adds their clout to it, then that only really helps China. And yet, we look down the list in the UK, Germany, Australia, South Korea, they've all decided that they want a piece of this. Why? Why do you think that they've decided to join?
Well, because it's a reality that's going to happen. You know, it's a reality. And I think that it's kind of the American approach of essentially put your hands on your ear and say, no, 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 is not in tune with that reality. You know, the idea, I think, from the British government and from all the other Western governments who got engaged in is they see that, you know, this institution has the potential to do good. Infrastructure and a lack of it is one of the huge problems in a lot of Asian countries. And so having another institution with $100 billion potentially on the table in terms of market capitalization to help invest in that infrastructure is not a bad thing. And so being involved in it from an early stage will help theoretically put you at the table to be able to help steer the organization a bit. I mean, the one caveat I would add about all of this is that, you know, while it's a very interesting new organization, I think it does signal something very important that China is trying to push out. I think it's worth keeping it in a certain context. So while this has a market capitalization of $100 billion, which is a lot of money, right? If you look at some of the bilateral trade stuff that China does with other countries in terms of investments there, like when Xi Jinping just went to Pakistan, he looked to do $46 billion just there alone. So, you know, we're talking about an institution that we need to kind of keep into a regional context, which is very interesting and very significant to watch. But also, you know, China bilateral stuff is frankly still the real story to be focusing on.
And Samira, again, there are a number of countries around the world that, whether it's through the AIIB or simply bilateral trade with bilateral investment, frankly, with China itself, they are far more interested in getting the money from China with no strings about human rights or how it should be invested or spent than to go down the Western route.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see that in big swathes of Africa, in Pakistan, as Raffaella was just saying. I think that's certainly the case. There's a sense that it's, there's obviously mixed opinions on this. One argument would be that it's sort of preferable to those governments because as you say, there's no strings attached. It's also on a more equal footing because it's sort of trade and investment and business interests as opposed to aid. I think the other argument that critics would make is that this ends up being sort of latter-day colonization. And you've seen in places like Zambia and Southern Africa backlash against the Chinese investors who they feel are sort of taking over and taking too many resources, etc.
And Raffaello, finally on this, do you think it will become, you know, as important as the Bretton Woods institutions that the IMF and the World Bank give it 5-10 years?
I think I would see it more in the light of an institution like the Asian Development Bank or the Islamic Development Bank, which is a bank which is very focused on regional things and has the potential to do some real good out there. But I don't think we're really seeing the reshaping of the world order.
Okay, now finally, let's turn back to President Barack Obama and indeed to Cuba, but this is a somewhat different story. The US president has this week appointed a new envoy to try to achieve one of his first promises to the US people when coming to power, the closure of the Guantanamo Bay detainment camp. Former National Security Council official Lee Wolosky is the latest person for the job. We're just over a year left of his presidency. Is this a goal that Obama will ever be able to achieve? Samira Shackle, this was, you know, one of his totemic first promises all throughout the campaign. He was going to close Guantanamo because he saw it as this sort of symbol of everything that was wrong with the way America was seen under George W. Bush. He promised he was going to get done within a year. He didn't manage it. He's got just over a year left. What are his chances of achieving it?
Looking pretty slim, I'd say. I mean, it's a shame because I think it was a good pledge to make, and I think it's a laudable aim. And I think it's true that Guantanamo is symbolic to many people all over the world. It's symbolic of the worst excesses of the US war on terror, and I think it would be of hugely important symbolic value to close that. However, I don't think you can really blame Obama for the fact that he hasn't been able to close it. I don't think it's...
Why not?
I think it's, well, because of the fact it's a sort of... It's not from lack of willing, I don't think. It's first of all, you've got, as we were talking about on our last US-Cuba story, with the fact that he's really hamstrung by an unsupportive Congress who can... I think one of the things that he wanted to do with these prisoners, because, I mean, that's the stumbling block. It's not because of a lack of will to close the prison. It's about where do you put these where do you put these prisoners? And he's been repeatedly blocked from bringing those prisoners who it is believed are guilty of a crime, who are not by any means the majority of them, but he's been repeatedly blocked from trying them in US courts or holding them in US prisons, which presents a huge problem, because then sort of where do you send them? But I would like to think that he could be successful in the next year. I don't envy Lee Wolofsky his job, though.
To be fair for a moment to Barack Obama, Raffaello, part of his problem was that there were certain people that, you know, they thought they felt they had evidence on, but by the time that Barack Obama took power, there was absolutely no way in the world that any court would be able to try them, because it wouldn't be a fair trial.
I mean, when are we going to see Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on trial? You know, the architect of 9/11 who's sitting there. We have no sense of when that's actually going to happen. There was a moment when they tried to push it through the New York courts. They thought we could do it there. New York court, the New York districts rejected the idea of him ever coming there, thinking it would be hugely dangerous. But then you're 100% right. The evidential trail. In some actual cases, they have managed to go back and piece it together, because what they've done is they've got sort of independent FBI teams that have gone and sort of re-interrogated people and recollected a lot of the evidence. And so in some specific cases, and I'd argue Khalid Sheikh Mohammed might be one of them, they could actually put up a trial in which they could convincingly make the case that the individual was one who, where the evidence wasn't stuff that had been obtained with torture. But that's certainly not true of all of them. And I think you're 100% right that that's one of the major stumbling blocks of this whole process.
And for example, on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Samira, it wasn't just that New York had issues over their security if he was going to be tried there. It's the fact that it's been revealed that he's been waterboarded 183 times. It's pretty easy for a lawyer defending him to stand up in court and say everything you gain from this is inadmissible.
Yeah, I think, and it's ironically the fact that it's proved so difficult to close the prison, I think, really highlights the problems with the prison. I mean, it's a bit of a Pyrrhic victory for those who criticise the prison, but it is nonetheless, it does demonstrate the issues with it. You know, you have this sort of place where normal constitutional rights and normal basics of human rights are suspended, and then at the end of it, you have a load of prisoners who you can't do anything with, and you can't try them, even if you're fairly sure that they're guilty of something, because you can't give them a fair trial because that evidence hasn't been obtained fairly. So it's, I think, really, really highlights the problems with that approach of this sort of, well, torture them, just get what you need.
And Raffaello, Obama's other problem as well is that it is deeply unpopular, and he may well have been able to try and force it through, you know, well, obviously he wasn't able to force it through in year one, but he may well have felt at times he had the political will or the political capital to do that at the start of his presidency. At the end, that's much, much harder.
I mean, it really is. And I think when I remember this was the first thing that he signed, I remember thinking and having a conversation with someone about it. I'm thinking, yeah, I don't know if that's going to be doable. And here we go, you know, however many years later it is, and it's clearly still not necessarily. I mean, you know, at the same time, we've got 116 left, and you know, they do manage to dispatch a few every so often, and this chap Lee Wolsey's job is basically going to be a case of going around to a lot of different countries and lobbying and finding out which ones will take maybe these five, maybe these two, and so there is a process of attrition that we can sort of whittle it down to. Once you get to that final group, then the question will be, you know, at what point is the US going to be able to establish some sort of a forum in which you can try these people and then transfer them from an illegitimate jail, which you want to close, to a proper one.
And I guess, Samira Shackle, the bigger issue here is that this sort of process is going to be a lot harder for the United States to do again, to, you know, once they've dealt with these prisoners here, to set up some similar program sometime in the future, is, given everything we now know, the torture report that the Senate committee brought out, it's unlikely that another administration is trying to go down this road.
Well, you'd hope so. I mean, I think if anything, it shows that it's not useful. I mean, the best thing that those agents can be doing is trying to build a case in which they can try people in a court of law and put them to prison for things they've done, instead of sort of holding them illegally indefinitely.
Okay, on that note, we'll leave it. Samira Shackle and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. Midori House was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Zuniga. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Ben Ryland will be here for the next half hour. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. And looking ahead a little later, do tune in to The Monocle Daily at 2200 hours London time. That's 1700 in New York City. Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will be your hosts tonight. Midori House will be back at the same time again tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.